Good evening, everyone, and welcome. It's wonderful to see so many people here this evening. Well, so welcome to this, the latest in our Women of Achievement lecture series, and I'm absolutely delighted to have the opportunity to welcome Valerie Amos here this evening. Now, to many of us, she needs absolutely no introduction, yet as Peter Wilby put it so memorably in his article in The Guardian about Baroness Amos earlier this year, he said, "The curious thing about Valerie Amos is most people have never heard of her, and those who have can't quite put their finger on what she's done. In fact, her achievements are staggering." End quote. The same article also gave her the ultimate accolade, certainly in the eyes of my daughters, in calling her the coolest of the cool. Valerie Amos was born in Guyana, but moved with her parents, both of whom were teachers, to Britain when she was 9. It must have been quite an adjustment, as she was the only black pupil at her East London Girls' Grammar School. Her undergraduate years were spent at Warwick, where she chose to read sociology because, as she put it, it was a cutting-edge course, including the sociology of gender and of developing societies. She went on to Birmingham, where the university department was run by Stuart Hall, the founding editor of the New Left Review. She worked initially for local governments in London before being appointed chief executive of the Equal Opportunities Commission in 1989. This, it's perhaps it's fair to say, was her big break. During her leadership, the commission underwent a transformation, taking on an altogether more active role. It was, for example, on her watch that the government was challenged through judicial reviews on rules that gave full-time workers employment protection after 2 years, but required part-time workers to have to wait 5 years. Baroness Amos drew people's attention to the fact that this rule discriminated heavily against women. 90% of the part-time workers were female. And as we know, she won the case. In 1994, she moved from the Equal Opportunities Commission to become an advisor to the Mandela government on leadership, change management, and strategy. In 1997, she was elevated to the peerage, where as a Labour member of the Lords, Amos served as the government spokesperson for Social Security, International Development, Women's Issues and Commonwealth Affairs. 2003, Baroness Amos was appointed International Development Secretary, becoming the first black woman to serve in a British cabinet. In September that year, she was named Leader of the House of Lords, a post she held until 2007. She became the UK's High Commissioner to Australia and from 2010 served as Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the UN, where she witnessed the escalating crisis in Syria. Baroness Amos was responsible for drafting Resolution 2139, demanding that all parties allow humanitarian access across conflict lines. She joined SOAS as its director in September 2015, the first black woman to head a UK university. In June 2016, she was made a Companion of Honour in the Queen's Birthday Honours List. Throughout the course of her career, she has also volunteered in the charity and NGO sector. She has served as a trustee for the VSO, for the Windsor Leadership Trust, Project Hope, the Institute for Public Policy Research, and the Runnymede Trust. So please join me in welcoming this extraordinary and very cool woman of achievement who will speak to us on values-based leadership in a changing world.
Louise, thank you. I'm not sure that my nieces and nephews would call me cool, but I do like the description. So thank you very much. And it's a real pleasure to have been asked to give one of the Women of Achievement lectures here at Oxford University. I have to say that when I was thinking about what to talk about, I hit on this idea of talking about leadership and global leadership and values-based leadership. And the more I started to think about it and to think about women in relation to leadership, the more I realised what a quagmire I have got myself into. So tonight I want to speak about leadership in a global context, explore what the current focus on values-based leadership actually means, and touch on the knotty question of whether women lead differently. I'm not sure I've succeeded, I have to say, when I reread what I was going to say, but I hope that it opens up some channels for discussion and communication. I'm going to focus very much on the public sector because that's the sector that I know best, but some of the data that I will draw on will come from the private sector, and I think that some of my conclusions, I hope, will also have some resonance in the private sector. I've been thinking about women and leadership a lot recently, and some of it, of course, relates to the dynamic of the recent race to select a new Secretary General of the United Nations. And there was quite a public debate about whether it was time to have a woman, and I'll come back to that in a moment. We, of course, have the upcoming US elections, where, if elected, Hillary Clinton will be the first female president of the United States. And of course, in the world that we have today, the United States is our one superpower. And here in the United Kingdom, of course, we have the change in leadership in the Conservative Party, which resulted in Theresa May becoming our second woman prime minister. Now, there's no doubt that the issue of whether women lead differently is a tricky one, because I think it's hard to make specific claims for one sex over another. But I do think that we need to continue to make the case for the contribution that women make to decision-making fora and in leading or being part of top teams. And there's ample evidence that that diversity does make a difference. It's all about bringing different perspectives. It's also about signalling change, about valuing all contributions, about showing girls and women that they matter. I don't think that we can underestimate the visual and emotional impact that that can have. What do I mean? I'm going to use two stories to sum up what I mean. I remember listening to President Johnson Sirleaf, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from Liberia, and she was talking about her experience of being a woman leader on the African continent, but also about the situation in Liberia itself. And she talked about the fact that she goes in and talks to, sometimes talks in schools, and she was talking to a group of school pupils, and she asked them what they wanted to be. And one of the boys put up his hand, and she said, "Well, what do you want to be?" And he said, "Madam President, I'd like to get into politics, and I'd like to be a vice president." And it's because his only experience had been of having women as presidents. So he thought that the furthest he could get to was as vice president. So I think that tells its own story. But I also remember in 2003 when I was made Leader of the House of Lords. At the time, I was Secretary of State for International Development. It was a job that I really, really loved. And very much enjoyed doing. So when the then Leader of the House of Lords, who was very popular, did the job extremely well, passed away unexpectedly, I had absolutely no idea that there would be any thought of moving me. I hadn't been in the development job for very long. And the job wasn't filled, and it wasn't filled, and it didn't matter that much because it was over the summer and Parliament wasn't sitting. And suddenly we had the Labour Party conference, and it was going to be important because we're going to come back and Parliament was going to sit after a conference and we needed to have a leader. And I remember asking who was going to be the new leader, and everybody was very sort of coy about it. We got back to London, and I got a call to go in to see the Prime Minister at number 10. And he basically said he wanted me to be the new leader of the House of Lords. And I said, I really like the job that I'm in right now, which was code for please don't move me. And he said again, I'd really like you to be Leader of the House of Lords. And I said, I really like the job I'm in right now. and realised that if he asked me a third time, I'd either have to say yes or I would be out the door. So he said, I'd really like you to be Leader of the House of Lords. And I said, thank you very much, Prime Minister. But what I had not bargained for was the difference that my being in that job would make to so many people. So when I became Secretary of State for International Development, I was the first black woman to be in a British cabinet. Paul Boateng was the first black person to be in a British cabinet, and people were very proud of me, and it was in the press, and I got a huge number of letters. When I became leader of the House of Lords, there was something that was visual about that for people. First of all, seeing me stand up in the House of Lords whenever they saw the House of Lords, but also it was the fact that it signalled that Britain had changed in a very powerful way just by having a black woman leader as leader of the House of Lords. That here was an institution that historically went back a very long way, where people perceived it in a particular kind of way. And I have another story that I'll tell you which sums up how people perceived it. I wasn't even leader then, but when I became a member of the House of Lords, I think it was in 1998, I was asked to go to a conference to represent the British government in Barbados. And there was a young protocol officer who was sent to meet me off the plane. And I could see him waiting at the bottom of the steps. And I came off the plane and I said, I think you're waiting for me. And he said, no, ma'am, I'm not waiting for you. And I said, I think you're waiting for me. And he said, I don't think so. He says, I'm waiting for Baroness Amos. I said, I am Baroness Amos. And there was a kind of silence. And then he said, and he just could not help himself, he said, I thought you were going to be some old white lady. So that kind of tells you what the perception of the House of Lords was like at that time. So my becoming leader just broke through all of that in one fell swoop. And it took me a very long time to accept that actually role models matter. And I resisted being called one for a very long time. And why was that? That's because, to me, I was just doing my job. I was doing my job as well as I could. I got, you know, if I got promoted, it was on the basis that I had, you know, worked very hard and, as far as I was concerned, was very good at what I did. I was not shy about acknowledging if I felt that I was good at something. So there's a sense in which women who are successful, we just get on with the job at hand as well as we can, and we do it in our own way. And it's quite often hard to give advice to others because people want to know, well, how did you do it? What particular things did you do? What distinguishes you from everybody else? And as a consequence of that, it becomes really quite hard when people say to you, you know, you're really my role model and I want to be like you, because of course we all do it differently, and it's partly about who we are and what we're about and what we bring. It's also partly about luck. But the thing that becoming leader of the House of Lords really taught me was why role models are so important and why the visualization of that is so important. And if you are a first, and I have had many firsts, or one of a few, you're also conscious that you're under much greater scrutiny. It's both personal and institutional, and there is a very strong motivation not to fail, which of course can be very wearing. Because you feel as if you are carrying with you the responsibility for all the women that come after. And it's so easy for organisations that you know, are not necessarily diverse, are not good about changing culture, having more women, having more women in positions of responsibility to say, well, we tried that and it didn't work. We tried that once and it didn't work. I mean, that's never gets said about men in organisations, but it does get said about women. So I've grown to accept it because it's about the young men and the young women who come after us, and particularly the young women who come after us, getting a sense of what is possible and not feeling constrained by the here and now and the what is, but really thinking about what is possible. And that's why I was so interested in watching the UN race, the fact that there was greater transparency, the fact that a debate was opened up about having women in senior roles, but it was a debate that somehow got very stalled, almost before it started, and I'm not sure why. And it's not for me about the result. Antonio Guterres, who has been selected, is clearly an excellent candidate. I worked very closely with him when I worked at the United Nations. He was in charge of the United Nations Agency for Refugees. But it's about where the women were positioned during that race. So Antonio Guterres consistently came out on top in the polls. But the women were mainly bunched up in the middle or towards the end. You'll remember there were about 12 or 13 candidates that started in the race. They were towards the bottom, towards the middle or towards the bottom, regardless of competence and ability. And because member states settled on one candidate so quickly, who was seen as outstanding, I think the deficiencies in the process, which relegated the women in that way, somehow got forgotten. Because there's no way, if you look at the list, leaving aside, you know, and Antonio Guterres at the top, that those women should have been bunched up where they were. When you think about who they were, about their abilities and their competence. So it was a salutary lesson for me. I have to say, not that I thought necessarily that the outcome would be very different to the way it was, but it was a salutary lesson because I think sometimes we forget that rhetoric doesn't equal action and that we always, always have to be vigilant, constantly have to be vigilant. I spent 5 years at the United Nations. For a very long time, I've been an internationalist. That's the way that I was brought up. I'm a migrant. I came to this country when I was 9 years old, grew up just on the borders of Southeast London and Kent. And as Louise said, I was the first girl at the grammar school that I, first black girl at the grammar school that I went to. My sister was the second 3 years later. So it tells you something about the kind of neighbourhood that I grew up in. But one of the things that was very important to us was that our parents always gave us a strong sense of self and belief in where we had come from. And I think that that experience of migration for me, and coming from Guyana, a small country, that at that time, small not in geographic terms, but in terms of population, at a time when Guyana was still a colony, meant that we constantly had this sense of looking outward. So that there was always discussion about what was going on in other parts of the world, at home, about how countries use their power and influence. And I remain a committed multilateralist, despite the challenges of working in a multilateral organisation, which I saw up front in my 5 years at the UN, particularly the challenge of working in a major bureaucracy in an organisation established to deal with one set of challenges in the post-Second World War world, struggling to really get it up itself up to speed and deal with the contemporary challenges. My job was coordinating the response to humanitarian crises at a time when they increased significantly, both crises of an international conflict-related nature, so not so much one state fighting another, but within states, but with countries which were proxies operating in those countries. And I had to grapple with coordinating UN organisations working on humanitarian issues, some with overlapping mandates, working with national and international NGOs, as well as working closely with colleagues in the International Committee and International Federation of the Red Cross. And I had absolutely no authority over any of those organisations. So I had a UN organisation that I was responsible for, which was the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, with about 1,200 staff, and then had to work on trying to coordinate the rest of this enormous system with billions of dollars coming in for humanitarian aid to make it as efficient and effective as possible, and to be a strong advocate for people in those countries who essentially were left with very little or nothing. I used to describe it as having the responsibility for delivery without the levers. And of course, there are all the governments to work with, the governments of the countries affected by crisis, governments who were donors, and sometimes governments who, as I said, were participants in conflict in another country. That experience taught me a lot about negotiating, influencing, building alliances, and the importance of having a strong political, with a small p, understanding of a situation. It also taught me that politics with a big P can really get in the way of getting things done. Even in a place like the United Nations, where everyone is supposed to have a shared commitment to the Charter of the United Nations, and the three blocks of that charter, which are about international peace and security, about development, but also about the promotion of human rights. The other thing that that experience taught me was that personal chemistry, getting on with someone, can make or break a delicate or sensitive diplomatic negotiation, because trust can help with overcoming almost anything. And I saw that, I mean, Louise very kindly mentioned the very first resolution that we negotiated, which was to enable humanitarian aid to cross borders to get into Syria, a major humanitarian crisis that unfolded during my time there. And in the 5 years that I was at the UN, I visited Syria seven times, as well as making frequent trips to places like Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, countries affected by the significant flows of refugees outside Syria and as a result of the conflict. And of course, I watched millions of people being displaced inside the country multiple times. But because there were such strong political differences between the permanent members of the Security Council about how to deal with the Syria situation, and particularly how to deal with President Assad and the government, there was essentially a stalemate. And I watched from my first visit, when I managed to persuade the government that they had a humanitarian crisis, and at that time they had about 1 million people needing aid, to the situation that we have today, where you have nearly 5 million people who have fled the country, nearly 7 million people inside the country who have been internally displaced, where the economy is shot to pieces, the currency has lost about 80% of its value, and where the major cities have essentially been destroyed. And yet something that seems so straightforward, which is that the Syrian government did not control the border with Turkey, the border crossings with Turkey. And the best way for us to get humanitarian aid, for example, to the people of Aleppo, was across one of those border points. But as a sovereign nation of the United Nations, they were able to argue that it was a breach of that sovereignty to bring aid across that border, even though they did not control it. And we needed a Security Council resolution to enable us to do that. It took a long time to negotiate. There were three countries that sponsored that resolution: Australia, Luxembourg, and Jordan. And we worked extremely closely together to make it happen. There isn't enough time to go into the ins and outs of how we made it happen. But without those three countries, without the ambassadors of those three countries, who were highly respected individuals, but I also think the fact that none of those three countries were actually permanent members of the Security Council. They were on the Security Council for 2 years as non-permanent members. And yes, Jordan had an interest as a country that was receiving refugees, but the other two didn't have, as it were, a direct interest. All of that contributed to us being able to get that resolution. But we had to be extremely patient, and we had to work by, you know, bringing people together, partly by shaming people into appreciating how the situation was deteriorating. But you'll see, even all of these years later, that situation in Syria is still not resolved. And so I'm very conscious that there have always been moments in our history when we have needed strong global leadership, particularly to bring about peace, security, and stability. And as we watch our world change, and as we watch the negative consequences of globalization dominate the political discourse in so many countries, as we watch conflict, poverty, and environmental degradation displace millions across the world, as we watch within our own continent the impact of Brexit, we know that we need strong global leadership now more than ever. Because what I saw at the United Nations was a paralysis in relation to Syria, which was caused by an inability to develop comprehensive strategies to address complex issues, including conflict, but also within the country, issues of justice in a politically, socially, and culturally sensitive and informed way. So we're in a world where we also have the challenges of greater connectivity and more information, but where you could also say we have less knowledge. A world where the legitimacy of multilateral organisations like the United Nations is constantly being challenged because they don't reflect real-world realities. And where politics plays an enormous part despite the lofty ambitions of, for example, the United Nations founding charter. So, given that I was working in the United Nations over that 5 years, I was very conscious that I was working in an organisation that was working, as it were, for the world. And I saw that in the makeup of the people around the table. A lot of attention was paid to geographic diversity and representing the interests of all the various parts of the world. And the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, who steps down at the end of this year, was personally committed to achieving gender parity around his senior leadership table. I do think it made a difference. I think it made a difference in the issues which were debated around that table, but also it made a difference in how those issues were debated. And I remember there was one occasion when I walked into a room. It was actually a meeting about something that was happening in Somalia, and there was a big difference across the different agencies. And when I walked in, I noticed that the majority of my colleagues from the other agencies were senior women from those agencies. And although we came at the issue we were going to discuss that day from different perspectives, we wanted to get to the same place. And I somehow knew, because it was a majority women, that we would get there, even though we didn't necessarily agree on the how, we were agreed on the objective that that we wanted to get to. So let me now turn to this tricky issue of the role of women in leadership and whether it's different. One of the questions often posed is, does the increased presence of women in leadership positions lead to improved performance? In the private sector, one way of measuring that improved performance is by looking at profitability. And I wanted to link what I said to research. And in February this year, there was a piece of research done by the Peterson Institute for Economics called, and I quote, "Is Gender Diversity Profitable?" They analysed nearly 22,000 companies in 91 countries. Nearly 60% of the companies had no female board members. Just over half had no female senior executives and members of the corporate board. And less than 5% had a female chief executive officer. The study showed a strong link between the presence of women in corporate leadership positions and positive company performance, i.e. greater profitability. That is, the positive correlation between the proportion of women in corporate leadership and profitability. The study reported, and I quote, "For profitable companies, a move from no female leaders to 30% representation is associated with a 15% increase in the net revenue margin." And that the largest gains are as a result of an increased proportion of female executives, followed by an increase in the proportion of female board members. Interestingly, just having a female chief executive had no noticeable effect on firm performance. Why? Well, I think it underscores a few things. One, the importance of actually creating a pipeline of female talent and not simply having a lone woman at the top. It's all about, for me, critical mass and being able to share the responsibility for the changes that you're wanting to make. The importance of being able to back each other up if you need to. And also, just the kinds of issues that you're able to put on the table. In the sector I am in now, higher education, the most up-to-date data comes from research that was carried out earlier this year by Women Count. It was published in March. In that report, it states that more women are taking leadership positions in universities, but still remain heavily outnumbered by men in higher education's top jobs. I was very conscious of this when I arrived just over a year ago. The first conference that I went to, and that's where Louise and I met for the first time, and having come from a United Nations that was very, very diverse, I walked into a lecture theatre, it was a bit bigger than this, and I was just struck by the overwhelming number of white men in the room. I was sort of taken aback by it. And everybody had said to me, oh, you're the first black woman to run a university, and I hadn't really factored that in when I got the job. But I walked into this lecture theatre, and there was another, I came in right at the back because I came in the afternoon, and I saw another black woman sitting down at the front, and I said, oh, well, no, I got really excited. I thought, nobody told me about her. And then when it got to Q&A, she got up to take the mic around. So you can imagine my huge, huge disappointment. But the sector is changing. One in three Vice chancellors hired over the past 2 years have been women, meaning that 22% of universities are now led by women, up from 17% in December 2013. You've got more women who are now governors or trustees compared to 2 years ago. And 19% of governing bodies are chaired by women, which is up from 12%. There are 8 cases where universities have a female vice-chancellor and a female board chair compared to the rest, which have a male vice-chancellor and a male board chair. I've got to give a little plug for SOAS because we're unusual in having Gracia Michelle as our president. I'm the director, and our incoming chair of Board of Trustees is also a woman. But we are not complacent. And nobody has yet complained that there are going to be 3 women in the leadership positions, but I'm waiting to see. Diversity is absolutely vital for a place like SOAS because it's in our DNA. Our students come from 130 different countries. We're not very big. We are about 5,500 students on campus. Then we have about 4,000 distance learning. Our students come from about 130 countries, our staff from 90. We think all of this contributes to our excellence and the way that we look at the world through a different lens. But even with that diversity, we are concerned that in terms of our number of female professors, it's much lower than we like. And certainly in terms of black women professors, it's also much lower than we would like. And if you look around the world, in many parts of the world, there's an overwhelming absence of statistical data on women and leadership in higher education. And in many countries, women are not being identified and prepared for leadership. There's ample evidence that women do aspire for leadership positions, but they are frequently rejected. When I first began thinking about these issues around leadership and diversity in the 1970s and 80s, and yes, I have been around a long time, discrimination and stereotyping was very, very blatant. I mean, we are shocked today if somebody, if a woman is asked about her intentions in terms of having children or getting married. That was de rigueur at that time. And there were a lot of books which were being written at that time which talked about women bringing very different things to leadership. Women leaders were seen as being less hierarchical, more cooperative and collaborative, more oriented to enhancing the self-worth of others. So I wanted to check whether the research actually substantiates the kinds of claims that were being made then, some of which continue to be made now. There are hundreds of studies which have assessed the leadership styles of male and female leaders since the 1950s. And there's a meta-analysis by Alice Eagley of Northwestern University and her colleagues, which found that sex-related differences are present in leadership style, but that the differences, and I quote, take the form of highly overlapping distributions of women and men. In other words, the differences are small. One of these differences is that female leaders, on average, are more democratic and participative than their male counterparts. Men, more than women, adopt a top-down command and control style. Well, in today's organisations, I think that is definitely old-fashioned. And another generalisation is that women, more than men, combine feminine and masculine leader behaviours to create what's called an androgynous style. Can you imagine an androgynous style? Which they call transformational leadership, which encompasses several types of leadership behaviours. Talking about transformational leadership is the new way of talking about the new kind of leader. Inspirational role models, leaders who foster good human relationships, develop the skills of their teams, and motivate others to expand their skill base beyond what's in their job description? Well, if you think about where I started and the qualities I identified as being crucial to leadership in today's world, I think they are summed up by this notion of transformational leadership. And that same analysis showed that women are somewhat more transformational than male leaders. And they distinguish between transformational and transactional or incentive-based leadership, which showed that female managers tend to motivate staff with positive reward-based incentives, where men offer a larger measure of less effective and more negative threat-based incentives. So it provides some evidence that women do have a different, I hesitate to say better, leadership style. Because I still think it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell the reason for these differences and how they actually translate into what we do in practice. I believe very strongly that women are judged by very different standards to men. I have seen it, but it's really hard to measure. And also because so much of it you know instinctively, but it's hard to describe. A year ago, when I started at SOAS, we had a major incident on our campus where we had a number of our students who were engaged in a protest. I came out because I wanted to have just have a sense of what was going on and what the issues were. And a police van suddenly pitched up. So I went over to them because I didn't know who had called them, and I thought that all it would do would be to exacerbate the situation. So I went over to the van, and you know, they rolled down the window, and I said, you know, I'd like to know who called you and what you're doing here, because I don't think that your presence is going to be very helpful. And a policeman leant out of the window and put his arm on the window, and he said, "And who are you, dear?" I'm pretty sure that any of my male colleagues would not have had the same response. And I was completely taken aback because I had forgotten. It had been such a long time since I'd been treated like that. I had forgotten what it was like. And when I told him I was a director, I don't think he believed me. So, you know, wherever we get, we do continue. It may be in a different form, but we do continue to face these issues where, you know, who we are and how we are judged, we are judged very differently. There are times when it's much clearer. Just look at what's happening now in the United States in the way that Hillary Clinton is being judged as against how Donald Trump is being judged. You don't have to take a political position. You just need to watch what's going on. I think culture also plays its part. I don't think that you can divorce who you are as a society and what's going on in a society and the values that that society has from the way that women are looked at and treated in that wider society. And I believe very strongly that here in the UK, we are not as far forward as we should be, because somehow it is still seen as acceptable that this discrimination continues. And I don't know where that, well, I partly know where it comes from, but it's 2016 and I still have a real issue with grappling with that, particularly as we have brought up young men and women to feel very strongly, and particularly our young women, that they can achieve on the basis of being good at what they do. And the reality is that in and of itself still is not enough in some cases. So there are a lot of elements that impinge on how we look at women and women in leadership of positions in societies. The conclusion of much of the research is that the small differences detected in leadership style between women and men are consistent, as I said, with highly overlapping female and male distributions. So descriptions of female leadership styles which talk about, you know, particular aspects of it are somewhat exaggerated. And of course, I think that is our experience as women leaders, that it's really about our individual leadership style. It's about the things that we value and what we want to bring to the leadership table. But beyond leadership style, there are other differences that may be more important in terms of how we lead. And that's about values and attitudes. What do we want to achieve as leaders through our leadership positions? How do we want to use and exercise the power and influence that we have? There are some cross-national surveys that have shown, in general, women place more emphasis on the social values, on what's called the social values of benevolence, a term which I have a little bit of difficulty with, but what they describe as the preservation and enhancement of the welfare of people with whom one is in frequent personal contact. And that women also place a lot on universalism, the understanding, appreciation, tolerance and protection for the welfare of all people and for nature. Similarly, other research has found that women endorse social values that promote others' welfare. And in some research that has been done looking at women in parliament, for example, women as part of legislative bodies, women are more likely than their male colleagues to advocate for changes that promote the interests of women, children and families, and that support public welfare in areas such as healthcare and education. Some further research has shown that the proportion of women on corporate boards in the Fortune 500 predicted the company's philanthropy and charitable giving. And I found that particularly interesting because there's also research that shows a direct correlation between a company's social responsibility policies and the attractiveness of that company, not just to women, but also to men. So there is a lot of change going on in the way that women and men are looking at these issues. Ethical attitudes are also important for leadership. Analyses of studies on ethical beliefs and decision making have shown that women are more likely than men to support ethical business practices. But again, I think that that will change and has started to change in any event. And having more women in parliament has been associated with having less political corruption in a parliamentary system. But it's still not clear if these areas that demonstrate the importance of ethics and values to women, for example, if these in any way advantage women leaders. I think that as a lack of success in a leadership position or failure is so much more public, the impact that it has on leadership style is having an impact on men and women. Reference the current debates, for example, about British Home Stores and Philip Green, or indeed about Sports Direct and Mike Ashley. The only way that we'll really know is when more women are in positions of power, because I think when we're in a minority, as we continue to be judged differently, then the outcome, what it looks like, is very different. So I wanted to end with two quotes. The first is from researcher Alice Egley, who I mentioned before, who concludes, and I quote, "To find out whether our societies would thrive and prosper if women shared power equally with men, more women would have to hold the reins of power. My best guess is that the gains of moving expeditiously in this direction far outweigh the risks." My second quote is from something that Barack Obama said in his farewell speech to the United Nations General Assembly this year. He said, and I quote, "Visions cannot deliver security or prosperity over the long term if they fail to recognise at a very basic level our common humanity." At the end of the day, that's what I think is at the heart of global leadership. It has an impact on every single one of us, every single day, and it's that that I bring, I hope, into the way that I lead what I call a belief organisation. Thank you very much.